Hello.
This call is being recorded.
Hey, how are you?
Yes. Very good. How are you?
Not too bad. All right. It's Andy Thunders here from Uncivil Revolt Webzine, and I'm here with Blaine Cook of the Accused AD, Dead America, 10-minute warning, the farts, and probably more that I'm not, you know. It's a pleasure.
Probably a couple others.
Oh, yeah. We can get all into that as you like. How are you doing, man?
I'm doing pretty good, yeah. Nice Wednesday afternoon here in Seattle.
Yeah, Chad was saying he's been enjoying the sun you guys have recently had. You don't usually get that a couple days in a row.
Not this early in the year, we don't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, can't say the same here in New York. It snowed today, and it's 32 degrees.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, shit. Well, that sucks.
you got to think, we're right near Lake Erie, and basically we get all the lake effect from all the different lakes that are around us because we're on the other side of Buffalo. You know what I mean?
Right.
So.
Yeah.
But,
yeah, we've got snow not too far out of the city. Yeah, if you go 45 minutes out of the city, it's snowing. But we don't have that.
A few things like a month back about them, you guys getting snow. I remember that.
Yeah.
Really makes you wonder. All righty. So I guess we'll get down to business. So what was it like growing up when you did in Seattle or in Washington State? And what made you want to be involved in music? Was there a certain, what moment was it? What band, you know?
That's quite a question. I mean, just going to how I got into playing in a band.
What inspired you? You knew that's what you wanted to do.
I wouldn't say that there was anything that said that I wanted to do it. It's just kind of like, that's kind of like what you did, back at that point in time, whether or not you could play or not. If you had a couple of buddies, you'd have a band. It's just kind of something you would do, I guess no different than, going out and playing baseball or something like that. That's just what you did. Later on people called them fuck bands. If you had an instrument or had access to an instrument, whether or not you could actually play or not really didn't matter. You gave it the old college try. Yeah, it wasn't really anything. Nothing really deliberate. It's just, that's just kind of one of the things that you did.
Well, probably because it was raining all the time compared to most places in the country. I'm sure that had a part to play, and there wasn't really that much you could do, I'd imagine, too. I've heard say that, too.
Well, I don't know. I think the whole rain in the Northwest in Seattle, I think it's a little over-exaggerated. So, I mean, we did a lot of skateboarding and going to shows and hanging out and all of that business, but actually playing in a band back there was harder than it is now. If you had equipment, it was expensive. The economics in the early 80s were a lot tougher than they are now. If you try to
around then, but
if you try to practice if you,
a lot of
yeah, you know, Andy, you keep you keep cutting out.
Wow, can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Okay, I've done a lot of history, and I've seen where like the late 70s and the early to mid 80s were pretty rough. with economics and everything going on at that time period. So I can imagine having a PA system to yourself was a luxury back then.
Oh, I didn't have my own PA until the late 80s. You know, if I had an amp, and a speaker and a microphone and a mic cord, that's what I would have. I mean, shoot, you know, back then, you know, PA is going to cost you over $1,000, you know, that was, you know, never, you know, I remember going and buying my first, I had a little, you know, combo PVPA head, you know, and I think at that point in time was a, you know, couple $300-$400 and, you know, and then just some crappy speakers.
Whatever works, right?
back then, yeah, most definitely. Whatever works, yeah.
And I've always found that it didn't matter what you were playing on. It just mattered who was playing it or what you did with it. That seemed to be what really mattered, not how much special equipment you had. That seemed more of a heavy metal thing than what you guys were about.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You know, we did at that point in time, yeah, we definitely weren't heavy metal, that's for sure. And we definitely didn't have any money, you know, back then when I think, you know, you're getting working a job, you know, $2 an hour or, you know, something like that.
Talk about being a cook book when he was in the farts and stuff like that. He said everybody
Andy, you keep cutting out. I'm only hearing like about half of what you're saying.
Oh, I was just saying that Duff was, in Duff's book, he even mentioned he was a cook throughout most of, you know, 10-minute warning in the farts career, and that everybody just had day jobs back then. It wasn't a money thing at all.
Oh, yeah, totally. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And most people worked in restaurants. I mean, because that's what there was. It wasn't really, you know, if you were from Seattle, you'd work at a restaurant, or if you had the connection, you would go to Alaska during the summer and work on a fishing boat. I mean, there wasn't really a whole lot that you could get into doing, you know.
Those were cool options you had. Damn.
Well, I mean, there were others, but you know, not, you know,
yeah,
there wasn't. Yeah, what wasn't a lot of options for the average person.
All right. So was the Farts your first band, or were there like a few like fuck bands like you mentioned that you were in before that?
No, the Farts, and you know, the Farts started off as a fuck band, you know. That was it. I had no musical talent whatsoever, but yeah. I think the first official fart show we did was at a house that we all lived in, but we did another thing for like this New Year's Eve party, you know, where we called ourselves the Farts, but it was a whole bunch of other guys, and we did like a version of Louie Louie. That was
nice.
Yeah.
So who was in the Farts in the early days? What was the lineups? Because I understand there's a lot of blurred lines with not just your bands, but other bands within that area at that time.
Well, I was just, in the Farts, the original formation of the Farts. There was Steve Hoffman, a.k.a. Steve Fart. And I guess if anything, he would have been considered the leader of the band. And he was the bass player. And then you had me, Blaine, a.k.a. Zippy. I was the singer. Our first guitar player was Tom Hansen. And our drummer was a guy that goes by the name of Loud. And when he was in the Farts, he was Loud Fart. And Tom Hansen, well, Loud had a band called Chaos. Like back then there was, you know, I think most big cities had a band called Chaos, but he was in a band called Chaos. And then for a little bit, Tom Hansen was in, was in Chaos with Loud. Loud was, you know, he was a little bit older than the rest of us. Tom Hansen and I, we were pretty much just out of high school.
Gotcha.
And then I think Steve was, he was three or four years older than us, and I think Loud was just a little bit older than that, maybe, you know, about 6 years older than we were. And
gotcha.
Yeah, that was the original lineup of the Farts, and we did that for a while. We recorded a single that we put out on our own, because that's another thing that you did if you were, you know, put out your own record. I mean, that was kind of like modeled after, you know, what Black Flag was doing. And there was another Seattle band called Soldier that we were friends with. And, you know, that's what they did. They, you know.
I knew they were going to pop up. I couldn't wait.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, yeah, Soldier. So they put out their own single, and they actually recorded some of that single at the house that we lived at. They had a buddy that had a four track. So he came out, and I think it was Filippo Scrooge was the guy's name. That had the four track. And yeah, and they put out their single, and you know, we did ours, you know, not too long after they did theirs. And then we played a show with the Dead Kennedys, and I believe that Jello Biafra had already heard our single, So we went, and there was an older gentleman in the punk scene back then, and his name was Michael Manning, and he was a little bit older. He had traveled over to Europe. He had stayed with Crass. For a while, and he gave us like $150 to go and record. So then we went and we recorded the follow up to our single, and I think that was after Tom Hansen left, and then Paul Soldier came to play with us. I always get there was so much that happened in such a short period of time.
You were in the early days, I would say.
Well, I'm sorry. Once again, you keep cutting out. So I didn't hear what you said.
It just seems like that's the same story for like the first two bands you were in. Then a lot happened in a short amount.
Yeah, totally. Well, I mean, you know, between the time the Farts played their first show to the time the Farts played their last show, you know, that was just about 2 years. And then from the time the Farts changed their name to 10 Minute Warning to where they kicked me out of the band, I mean, that was only like about 5 months later.
Damn.
Yeah, everything happened, you know, to your younger, you know, everything is fresh and new and exciting. And yeah, there was a lot of stuff that happened in a very, very short period of time.
And it's just crazy to look back and be like, how did we do all of that in that short amount of time? You know?
Yeah, I mean, I don't really even think it was really anything anybody really even thought about, you know. I mean, I don't, you know, I know there's definitely shows that I forgot that we've done, that we did, you know, as the Farts, you know, that was, you know, it was 40 years ago, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
I try to remember as much as I can, but, you know, I've been pretty much doing stuff ever since then, you know. Yeah, there's a lot to remember, and I didn't really start paying attention, as I like to say, you know, not until probably my until my 40s when I really started paying attention.
So I've got another 10 years before I have to start paying attention is what you're telling me.
No, if, you know, that depends. I know that's what I did. So, yeah, that's up to you.
Okay. All right. I was just curious. I didn't know if there was, like, a certain manual on how, you know, men age or anything like that. I'm starting to get 30 part. So, you know.
Yeah, no. No, I think you just gotta stay healthy and have some good living. Yeah.
I always value my time, and I think that's what a lot of people need to realize, is time is really all you've got at the end of the day.
Yes. Yep.
So the farm.
Most definitely.
Second single, and you were given $150 to do that. What would that?
It was a 12-inch that we did.
Okay.
So and that was, you know, we did that in a studio that back then it was called Triangle Studios, and later on the building turned into later on it turned into Reciprocal, and that's where Jack and Dino and, you know, all those, you know, all that Nirvana and Mudhoney and a bunch of that stuff, you know, that was all done there. With Jacket Reciprocal.
Were you a fan of any of those bands, by the way?
Not particularly. That wasn't really what I was into.
Okay.
You know.
Yeah, I was just curious because you were kind of the band that and maybe had influenced a lot of those guys. So I was just kind of curious, you know, I mean,
you know, maybe the 10 minute warning may have had some influence, you know, on Green River and Mudhoney. Definitely the stuff that we did later. No. Yeah.
Yeah, because the stuff you did in The Accused is definitely different than the stuff you were involved in before, too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, whole different thing.
Now, as you got older, were you more appreciative of metal? And is that why there is a slightly... It's not full-blown metal, but there is some metal riffage in a lot of the Accused music. Was that a conscious effort, or is that just what you guys played and made it work?
That's just what we were into, you know? I mean, I started getting into the metal, you know, pretty early, you know, like when that, you know, Motorhead Ace of Spades, you know, was released domestically. And then, you know, there was a couple, some of the, you know, what was later called the new wave of British heavy metal. You know, some of that stuff was getting over here. You know, then that, you know, you listen to, you know, like the first, you know, Iron Maiden, you know, the Killers LP, you know.
I think those first two records are the best thing Maiden has ever done, in my honest opinion.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And when you're listening to that, you know, back then, it's, you know, it's even more... Oh. You know, more impactful.
Okay, so yeah, because Buzz Osborne also said he never got the memo that, you know, if you're from Seattle, you're supposed to hate heavy metal.
yeah, I don't, you know, that was, you know, I think we got, you know, when we were doing The Accused, you know, we definitely were very popular. We had a big following. We played big shows. But there's always that group of people that thought that what we were doing was, like, you know, stupid, juvenile, you know, speed metal, you know.
I wouldn't
stupid
go that
speed metal stuff. You know, and that's how some people felt. You know, there was that division. So it's like, if you're, you know, it's either you're a stupid guy playing speed metal, or you're a stupid guy playing, you know, Stooges, you know, rehash, you know, Stooges riffs, you know, it's like, you know, one or the other.
you can't win either way, so you might as well do what you do.
Right, and that's it. Right, that's what we did, and that's we, you know, and we still do that to this very day.
Was it a conscious effort to make Martha Splatterhead like your mascot, kind of akin to Eddie's Iron Maiden, or was that just one of those accidents?
Oh, I'm sure you know that, you know, definitely she's, you know, probably in some way modeled after Eddie. But, you know, wanted her to be a female so that she was a female, you know, killing guys versus a guy killing females, you know, try to be a little bit more on the PC level of things.
I dig that. I fully support it. Equal opportunity. Hey, makes you stand out a little too, you know.
Right.
I find that funny because in a lot of the modern stoner doom metal bands that I listen to, they have a lot of female singers, and it actually adds an extra eeriness to hear or even just have the image of Martha Splatterhead. It's more eerie and I think scary when it's a woman, because you wouldn't normally think of a woman in that context. So I think it works better in the shock value in that way. You know,
yeah. Yeah, most definitely.
So, and I'm sorry, I know it's back and forth because I don't know how much time you have, you know, and I know, you know, we both got stuff going on. But so the Farts recorded a 12-inch. What would the $150 be in today's, like, with inflation to today? Like, how big of a deal was that, if you can give any idea?
That was it was a lot more expensive to record back then, you know, than it is now, because everything is in the digital format. And that was like one day. That was a couple of hours in the studio. And we had to rent the tapes, just because, you know, back then everything was you're recording on two inch tape. And probably back then, you know, a 2-inch tape was probably still like $75. So, you know, we rented the 2-inch tape, and I think we bought, you know, then we bought a quarter inch tape that it was, you know, mixed down to. But I mean, that was like, yeah, $150. That was, you know, whatever time we showed up at the studio, you know, 5 o'clock in the afternoon. And, you know, whenever we got out of there at like, you know, 10 or 11, that's, you know, that's what it was.
Wow. So it was pretty much done live then, I'd imagine, in the studio?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, totally. Yeah, yep, totally done live.
Awesome. So, like, with the 2-inch tape, how many minutes of music could you fit onto that? Just so for our younger
15.
Listeners, no idea what we're talking
you
about.
You can get 15 minutes on a 2-inch tape.
And that's what you were recording on.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's what everybody, I mean, that was pretty much the standard.
Yeah.
You know, and then you had to be perfect. Because if you had to do, you know, if there was something that had to be fixed, you'd either have to go and redo it, or, you know, if you worked with somebody in the studio that was really good at splicing tape, you know, versus how you do it now, everything is in a file, and, you know, you just have your guitar track, or you have your hi-hat track. And if you're playing a song now, and it's like you're playing the song, it's like, well, I like the way the hi-hat sounded right here, but I don't like how it sounds over here. Well, you just kind of copy and paste, you know, hey, this, you copy and paste this hi-hat sound over to this other, you know, and replace it.
Yeah. It takes 2 seconds.
It was a lot. Yeah. Yeah. But back then it was, you know, everything was, it was very, very manual. You know, that's one of the reasons why people would spend, you know, months, you know, recording, because it would just take fucking forever. And if you were a big rock band or something, shoot, you might spend a whole week in the studio where they're just you know, getting drum sounds. You know, that was always the most, you know, the most grueling part was, you know, you got to listen to him, you know, hit the ride cymbal for an hour, you know, so the guy can, you know, get it all dialed in.
I think I read an interview with AC/DC, and they talked about working with Phil Rudd on For Those, or Mutt Lang on For Those About mm-hmm. the Rock. And the reason why they don't really do much from that album anymore or really give that album any love, they spent going to three different studios to try to get a proper drum sound, and they were so fed up with it by the time they finally put it out.
Yeah.
I'm yep. like, good.
And now you just put in, you know, whatever, you know, whatever you want it to sound like, and that's what it's going to sound like, you know.
Exactly. I just ask those things to share with any younger people who might be listening to this who, you know, wouldn't understand what you had to do back then versus today to make a recording, you know?
Yeah, and that's on top of, you know, going to a studio where you're working with somebody that, you know, when you start playing music, they're going, you know, what the fuck is this? What's this shit? You know, what am I supposed to do with this? You know, and that's, you know, that was part of it as well.
Wow. So after you released that 12-inch, how many copies were released? What did you do after that? You know, what shows? Anything special?
I don't even know. I don't even know how many that sold back then. We kept playing shows. We got Paul Soldier started playing guitar with us. We played some more shows. We did a short run of shows down the West Coast where we were playing with Discharge and the Bad Brains.
Nice.
And that was in my years mixed up. That was near the end of 1981.
Okay.
I believe near the end of 82.
All right.
Yeah, so that was like in October of 82. Yeah, we were doing those shows. We were working on new material. We got back from doing those shows, and our drummer Loud quit, and we fired him, or you know, whatever it is that happened. And then we got Duff McKagan to play drums with us.
Yep.
and then we recorded five songs with Duff, and we released those as a cassette called Survival of the Fittest.
Okay.
And we released it we released those songs as the farts. And then we decided to change the name of the band to 10 Minute Warning.
Okay.
And then those songs were on, I don't know, four or five, six different compilation records back then. Some of the records.
Mind me asking.
But I, what was that now?
What songs were on that, if you don't mind me asking?
It was Is This the Way, Buried Alive, Judgment Day, Resistance, and then a song called Dead Soldier, that was a song that Soldier did.
Yeah, I have the MIA record, and Paul doesn't even know what's on it, but that was one of the ones I recognized because the 10-minute warning record I bought from you.
Yeah.
And didn't know that you were also in The Accused at the time, who I also adored. I just, yeah. yeah. So it sounds like basically you were off to a good start. Were those songs new other than Dead Soldier, or was that just what you recorded?
to put out.
No, those were new songs that we had been playing live, and that we had been playing with Loud. There was a couple others that we had that were kind of got lost in the shuffle, and then so that was in November of 1982 that we did that. We played one show while we were Spill the Farts with Duff on drums, and that was in Portland, and we played with Poison Idea and another band from the Seattle area called The Rejectors. Were on that show, and then the band, then The Accused, they showed up because they were friends with The Rejectors. And they showed up at the show and wanted to see if they could play, and they got to play that night as well. And
nice.
I think it was probably Duff was doing something for the holidays, so he was out of town. And then I think when he came back, I think that's probably around the beginning of December. That's when Steve Hoffman, aka Steve Fart, that's when he decided he was going to quit the band. And
oh, wow.
So that's when we were just, strictly 10-minute warning then. And that's when Duff moved to play second guitar, and Paul Soldier played lead guitar, and I was still on vocals. And we had a guy named David Griggs that was the bass player, and a guy named Greg Gilmore that was the drummer.
Gotcha.
And yeah, we did that. I mean, we played, some of those, those songs that were fart songs that we turned into 10-minute warning songs.
Was
the arrangement.
One of them.
Pardon me?
I'm sorry. I have to ask this because it's my favorite song by 10-minute warning. Was Friday the 13th one of those?
No, that was one that we did after Steve left.
Okay. I was just curious if that had any parts or, where that song came from just because I freaking love that song.
that's a fun one. And so then that takes us into 1983, and as 10-minute warning, we were lucky enough to do some more shows with the Dead Kennedys. We played with them here in Seattle, played with them in Portland, played with them in Vancouver, BC. We did a weird show. Yeah.
What were you like back then live in person? Because I can only watch YouTube clips. What was the Dead Kennedys like live in person back in their, heyday or peak, you could say?
They were killer. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I only imagine and see from YouTube videos, so I was just wondering what it was like in person to see Jello Biafra just do his thing and run all over the stage.
Yeah, it was great. I mean, everything was great back then, because that's where it all came from. That's when it was the best.
Yeah. Oh, man. I'm envious.
Yeah, well, that's one of the, one of the things about getting old. It's like, if you were there,
Yeah.
Oh, but, I had the opportunity back then to see, there was a lot of stuff that I saw, and then there was a whole bunch of stuff, that I didn't see. But it was, those were good times.
Are we getting towards the end of your tenor and 10-minute warning here as we're approaching 1983? I know a cutoff point at some point here that wasn't that.
Yeah, so
long.
we did Yeah, well, we did those shows with the Dead Kennedys. We did a couple of local shows. We did kind of a weird all the heavy metal people in this area were kind of from the east side, and they did their shows at this at a roller rink. So we got to play, you know, one of these shows with Culprit and the Wild Dogs. Wild Dogs were a metal band from Portland. Culprit was a big Seattle area heavy metal band. And we did that show. So that was kind of a trip. And
how did they respond
when we
to you?
Played? You know, I don't really remember. I don't really remember if they really dug it or not, you know.
Let's just carry
it. And then,
some reason, metalheads really hate punk. And there's so many parallels to both genres that it doesn't matter.
Yeah, well, that was before that became apparent. You know, that was kind of like a different kind of a metal. And, and then I was out of the band probably by, like, April of 83.
Do you know why?
I wasn't cool enough. They wanted to find a real singer. Yeah.
Wow.
So they booted me out. They got another singer. We did get together and do another show as the Farts with Duff on the drums. And that was on, I think it was the 4th of July, third of the 4th of July of 1983. And
So did you join? What happened with the Accused and in the interim? Like, how much time between 10 Minute Warning till you joined the Accused?
I joined the Accused in the spring of 1984.
So almost a year after.
Yeah. Just about a year after.
Okay. What were you doing during that year? Like,
I was going to school for a little bit. I was a volunteer at a child care center.
Oh, wow.
I did that for about a year. As a matter of fact, I was still a volunteer. I think I started... I think I started volunteering probably the later part of 1983. I was playing guitar, with some buddies of mine. We had a little band.
Nice.
And, just carrying on, ride my skateboard, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Working.
Do you still skateboard, by the way?
No, I don't. Not for a while. Yeah. I blew my Achilles tendon some years ago, and I was never able to get the full muscle tone back in my calf.
So you can't even ride a cruiser or a longboard and just ride the cruise.
No, I still can, but I just can't, you know, skateboard it, you know, not that I was ever really that good, but I can't, you know, skateboard like I used to be able to.
But I ride a cruiser and a longboard now just because, you know, after so long of not doing it, I'm not going to risk getting an injury. You know, I don't heal like I did when I was a teenager.
Well, yeah. Yeah. Right. There's that as well.
Yeah. I mean, I'll let my kids learn how to do that on their own. I started my oldest daughter when she was like 2. She used to sit on the front of the longboard with me, and then she was riding it herself one day.
No, that's great. Yeah.
Yeah. So when did you get a call from the Accused? Did you go to them? How did that happen?
We were all at a show. We were actually at a GDH at a GBH show. And
Yeah,
they came up, I think it was Dana. I think Dana and Chewy came up and asked me. And Yeah, I think they have Dana and Chewy came up and asked me, and then I think like the next weekend, Dana's mom drove them down to Seattle because they lived up on Whidbey Island. Yeah, so I think Dana's mom drove them all down to my where I was living at my mom's house, and and we jammed, and then they booted their singer, and and that was the beginning of that.
Yeah, that's odd though, because Paul Soldier referred to you as the original Tasmanian Devil on stage. So, I mean, it seems odd that they would find for not being cool enough. But the Accused, I mean, did the fans receive you pretty well as the new frontman? Because I know sometimes that can be hard for people to take.
Well, there was during that point in time in Seattle, there was kind of a bit of a lull in live shows. So actually when we started doing shows as the Accused, I mean, after I was in the band, there wasn't really, maybe for like the first 6 months or so, there wasn't really much happening. And then when it, took off, the sound that the Accused had after I joined the band was different than it was when John Dahlin was the singer. When John Dahlin was the singer, it was more of that 83, 84, not necessarily generic, but I mean there was a very similar sound that a lot of bands were doing. And then if you could jump ahead, a year after that, when I was in the band, there was more of that, more of a metal influence. And my vocal style was much, much different than John's.
Yeah, that's the one thing, because when you sent me the Accused AD record you did recently, which we'll get to that then, I'm like, God damn. Guy still has one of the most unique voices I've ever heard.
Yeah. I do my best, I can't make all the sounds, that I used to be able to make. I do the best job I can.
Well, hey, and I commend you for it, and it's working. So
yeah,
when did you record with the Accused and all that, and tell me about that experience?
The very first recording we did with the Accused?
Yeah.
that probably was like in early 1985, and I was working with a gal, and she had just moved to Seattle with her boyfriend. And her boyfriend was a guy by the name of Chris Hanzik. And Chris Hanzik had a little 8-track recording setup that he had in this weird, kind of like the top part of the building. It wasn't really a warehouse space. It was more like he had the space in this building that was like a couple of offices. And he had it set up in there.
Gotcha.
And we recorded... five songs with him probably over the course of a couple of 2 or 3 weeks. And and then we used those songs and we put out our own record called the Martha Splatterhead EP.
Nice.
Yeah. Yeah,
and
that was that. I mean, pretty much, most of what we did, we recorded live. There might've been a little teeny bit of overdubbing, but, probably not too much.
It seems like you took that kind of garage band approach where you know what you need, you don't need to make too much. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, it was also, we did what we could afford to do.
Yeah.
So, you know, there wasn't like, there wasn't oodles of money. And, you know, when I first joined the Accused, Dana was still in high school. Tom and Chewy, yep. they were in community college. So, you know, it's not like, you know, anybody had any money.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, whatever little teeny bit that we made, you know, playing shows, that's, you know, what we used to do the recording.
As you did back then, you guys weren't the only ones doing.
Yeah. Right.
So you put
and then the first record we did, the Martha Splatterhead EP, you know, we just had plain red labels, because that was less expensive to do it that way. And then we had the, you know, just a Xerox cover, that we had a buddy of ours. He worked somewhere where they had a copy machine that did 11 by 17 copies. And he would go into the building at night and, run those copies off.
Nice. That's
yeah.
pretty cool. So did you tour off the back of that, or did you start recording the album?
No, we were doing shows. Yeah. Yeah. We were lucky enough, you know, the support of Jello Biafra, you know, continued, when I got in the Accused. So, you know, we did shows, we were lucky enough to do shows with the, Dead Kennedys, in both Seattle and down in San Francisco as well. I don't know if we really called it touring. We were just, you know, going out doing shows. It wasn't, you know, they were more like, you know, extended weekend, you know, type deals.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
But yeah. Yeah, no, we definitely played around. You know, we'd go play Portland all the time, you know. Portland, Eugene, San Francisco. We didn't usually drive down to LA back then, just cuz it was, you know, it's like a, you know, another long drive after San Francisco.
Yeah. Absolutely. There's a lot of miles between that. People don't realize that.
Yeah. Yeah.
You mentioned Eugene, Oregon, and Portland, and do you think that the atmosphere and everything surrounding, like, Washington State being, like, pretty much as far as you can go and still be in the United States, do you think that that played a part in the music that came out, including, like, bands like The Accused and stuff like that?
Not really, because I think back then every little city or town had a scene, and there was unique stuff happening all over the United States, you know, and Seattle was just Seattle and Portland, you know, they were just, you know, two more cities, you know, that had their own little thing going on. We might not have been like as well connected with other bands, being from Seattle, like, you know, like if you were, you know, if you were, you know, like from Chicago or Detroit or New York or something, you know, everything over there is a lot closer together than it is over here.
Gotcha. Yeah. Now I was just curious, because I know there's a lot of occult stuff in the Pacific Northwest, and a lot of, you know, you had so many serial killers and all that kind of stuff. So I didn't know if that played themes of the music that are, you know.
If it did, I don't know. It definitely wasn't anything that we were thinking about at the time. That's for sure.
So if it did, it wasn't anything conscious that you thought about.
No. No, absolutely not.
So when did you record the debut album by The Accused then?
Well, the first one we did, that was a 12-inch. That was the Martha Splatterhead EP. And then we recorded probably later night 1985, and we did another 10 songs, and then we put the songs off of that session with the Martha Splatterhead EP songs, and that was the Return of Martha Splatterhead LP.
Gotcha. All right.
So, I mean, if that was, you know, that was probably the first, you know, the first official one. And we had a guy in Seattle that had a record label called Sub Core. And he put that out here in the United States. And then we had it licensed in the UK on a COR Records, which was a Children of the Revolution Records, which later became Earache.
Oh wow! Okay.
And I believe we were either the first or the second thing they did on their label.
Oh wow!
And then we got that record released on Combat Relativity. So there was actually, at that point in time, there were three versions of that record, and each version had a different cover.
Wow.
And then when it was released, by the time it got re-released on Combat, which would have been sometime probably the later part of 1986, that's when, by then we had gotten rid of the original Accused bass player, Chewy Chabon Batterman, and he was replaced by Alex Maggotbrain. So that's why if you see the Combat release of the Return of Martha Splatterhead, that's what the live picture on the back of the record is. What the lineup was when the record got reissued.
Gotcha. Makes sense at the time, I get it.
Yeah, it made sense at the time, yeah.
How was that record received when it was first released, and how is it viewed now? And does it differentiate at all, you think?
People loved it. Yeah. Yeah.
I still do, obviously.
I like all of the records. I mean, there's definitely records that there's songs on some records that I like more than others, but you know, each record, I mean, it's just like a little time capsule of what we were doing at that point in time. You know, what our abilities were. And you know, with each record, you know, production value, you know, increased. You know, hopefully people's, you know, playing, you know, their playing ability increased. Definitely as the production value increased, that, you know, that's just how, you know, you got to start working with engineers that you know were more able to make sense out of, you know, the music that we were making.
Yeah. Which, you know, is part of the progress of being in an active band that's putting out releases. You're always finding new stuff, and sometimes you experiment, and sometimes it sticks, and sometimes you don't. You can name 100,000 done that, whether it was good or bad.
Right.
So how long did the original run of The Accused last then?
Well, from the time that I got into the band in the spring of 1984, probably till about 1990, I think is when we 1991. That's when we were signed to a Seattle label called Nasty Mix, and we were doing. We did our last record on Nasty Mix, which was called Splatter Rock. And right before that record was going to be released, that's when Tom Niemeyer, the last original member of the original Accused lineup, that's when he quit the band.
Oh, wow.
And we got somebody else to play guitar, because at that point in time, we had already had a we had a European tour that had already been booked.
Gotcha.
So, yeah, we, you know, went ahead. We Alex and I had done done some things with this guy. His name was Andy Massey, and he was a local Seattle guy, and he at that point in time was in a metal band called Terrorist. And Alex and I, we did a that's kind of like at that point in time, that's when people started doing all these, you know, these cover and tribute bands, or there'd be a, you know, there'd be a show and it's everybody's like, you know, I think one of the, we did one that was all Heart songs. And then we did a night where everybody's doing Black Sabbath songs. So we were doing,
cool.
We did Black Sabbath songs with Andy Massey, playing guitar. So when Tom quit, yeah, we just went ahead and got Andy Massey to play, and yeah, he picked up the songs really quick. We played with him for a couple of years after that. We did a couple of more European tours, and whatever it was, 92, 93, something like that, when we just, you know, that's when we, you know, we put it on the rack for a while, and then I think we got back together for the first reunion go that we did. That was probably in 96, latter part of 1996. We tried to do a reunion thing again, and you know, by then you're just kind of like, you know, a lot of that, you know, you're just like going through the motions. You know, you're going through the motions, and you're doing it to get paid at the end of the night. Yeah, so nothing really happened with that first reunion go we did. And then we did the reunion thing again. That last time that we did it, which was like, you know, 15 years ago. So, you know, whenever we, you know, started it, like 2004 or something like that.
Yeah. So what made it fall apart?
Yeah. Well, during the second reunion.
Yeah, maybe both.
Well, back then you would say that the culture of the band was not a positive one. In current terms, you would say that the culture of the band was, there was a toxic culture, and there was, you know, one of the guys in the band was constantly showed up to practice late, and that one person didn't have the same sort of employment that we had. You know, at that point in time, I was, you know, whatever, I was working with young kids. I'd been doing that for a number of years. So, I mean, it was technically, it was like my career. Alex had a career. The drummer had a career, and we'd have this person would show up late to practice. And, you know, there was never any apologies or anything like that. And then the same person, you know, would show up to gigs late. There was a couple of gigs that we had, that we almost didn't play, because he showed up so late. You know, and there was never a thank you. There was never a sorry. And this person, you know, also, you know, didn't show up for like sound checks and stuff like that. So there wasn't really, at that point in time, you know, you do music because you do it because you enjoy it. I mean, that really isn't, you know, we don't really do it, you know, as like an obligation, you know, maybe if we were going out and, you know, getting paid $10,000 or $15,000 a night, you know, you could do something like that as an obligation. But when you're doing it for fun, it just ends up being stupid. And if you don't have the camaraderie, as well as the respect, you know, for the guys you were playing music with. And it was really, you know, the stuff that was going on was, you know, it was disrespectful, you know. And then that was it. And then we all bailed on the accused, and then we started a band called Toe Tag.
Nice. Did Toe Tag have anything to do with eventually doing the accused AD?
Well, we're all the same guys, yeah. So, you know, we started doing Toe Tag, and since Toe Tag, we were essentially three quarters of the accused. You know, there was, you know, me on vocals, Alex Maggot Brain was now playing guitar, and Steve Nelson, who was the accused drummer, was playing drums. And, you know, we'd been doing Toe Tag, then our bass player, Steve McVay, we'd been doing Toe Tag, you know, for a while. And, you know, most people in the, you know, quote unquote underground, you know, scene, they were saying that, you know, that we were, you know, more of the accused, than what the accused were doing at that point in time. So we relearned a live set of accused songs, and we called ourselves Martha's Revenge. And
nice.
we did shows as Martha's Revenge. I don't know, for a couple, two or three years off and on, up and down the West Coast, you know, Seattle, Portland, Oakland, San Francisco, you know, that type of a deal. I think the biggest show that we did as Martha's Revenge is we got to open up for Gwar and Napalm Death and Municipal Waste.
Oh, wow. That's
so that was pretty cool. So we did the Martha's Revenge thing off and on during our Toe Tag career. And then when it got to be around the 30th anniversary of the release of the accused record, More Fun Than an Open Casket Funeral, we thought it would be fun to learn that record and play it all the way through, from, you know, side A to side B. And we went out and we toured on that, and we called ourselves the Accused AD as we did that. And that first time that we went out, we'd do the Accused AD, we'd do a Toe Tag set of Toe Tag material. Then we would do, you know, the old, accused material as the Accused AD. So we'd actually do two sets, and we did a short run, out there on the East Coast. And, then we did, we did it. You know, we did the Midwest, you know, playing those old songs. And then we just figured we were going to record again, because that's what we like to do every couple of years. And we just figured, you know, why don't we just release this new record? Well, let's not release it as a Toe Tag record. Let us release this as the Accused AD. And that is what we did.
And that's
it. But it's basically the same thing. Yeah, yeah, and that's the Ghoul in the Mirror. I mean, basically, Toe Tag and the Accused AD, I mean, it's just that it's the same band.
Yeah.
You know, we just play different songs. Yeah, and yep. we've gone through a couple of drummers that we had with the Accused AD. You know, we've got the guy that we've been playing with now. We've been playing with for about a year and a half, and the guy that we're playing with now, we used to play just the Toe Tag material with. And then the guy that we had that we played the Accused songs with, his name was Steve Hanford, a.k.a. the Slayer Hippie. And he was from Portland. We did, I think, the last stuff that we did with Steve as the Accused AD. We did about a two-week West Coast deal with I Hate God, Negative Approach. And,
nice.
Nice
names.
Oh, no. Yeah, I can't. I Final Conflict, and fuck. Now I'm forgetting the New York band that we played with. Ah, fuck. Yeah. And we did that, and then we did a couple of more local shows, and then the COVID happened, and since Steve lived in Portland, we'd have to drive down to Portland and pick Steve up with his drum kit and bring him back up here, and we rehearse at my house, and when the COVID thing started, then my wife had to work from home, so you know she couldn't really have him banging on his drums, during the day, or him bumbling around. So he didn't get to jam, and then he ended up having a heart attack, and then he died.
Oh, that's
And he was the one that the DEA project, the Dead End America, that was his project. Those were his songs, and
especially since you brought him up and he was involved in that, and I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
So Mike is in rest in peace. That included Mike IX from I Hate God and a bunch of others. Tell me about that project, because that record is astounding and brutal.
Yeah. Those were Steve's songs. He did the songs. He played drums on them, and he had another buddy of ours from Portland by the name of Tony Avila, and Tony played guitar, and then he had Nick Oliveri. Did Nick play the bass on those, or was that Ian?
But I know he played on it.
I can't remember. And then after Steve. After Steve passed away, Tony Avila just reached out, to these different people. You know, obviously he asked me, and of course I was going to do it. And reached out to Mike from I Hate God, and he agreed to sing one of those songs, and
it just
all came together.
That's
and I
really
think
cool.
either Mike or. Mike or Nick Oliveri, I think, had the strong connection with Greg Anderson at Southern Lord. They put it out.
Yeah, when you sent that to me, I was looking at it like, ooh, what's this? I'm like, Southern Lord, Mike IX with Blaine Cook and Nick Oliver. I'm like, yep. I was like, I have to.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's a pretty good little single. I mean, there is talk of doing some more stuff. So I don't know. We'll see what happens. I know that being on Southern Lord and with Mike and Nick Oliveri in the band, the record got a lot of press. I know they sold a bunch of them.
I Hate God for 12 years now, and seeing them grow as slowly as they did, because I know they were around since 88, long before I found them. But yeah, I was going to ask you if you enjoyed them and what it was like touring with them.
No, yeah. I mean, I didn't, Mike kind of stuck to himself. I think he was traveling. I don't know if it was his girlfriend or his wife. The other guy's really nice,
Gotcha.
Yeah, nice guys. Oh. Yeah.
I'm curious what you thought of their music, because I know it's, definitely unique. Some people can't handle it.
live, I liked them live. I mean, frankly, I heard them, back in the 80s. I heard them back then. I don't own any of their material, so I really if I had their material, I'd know I could sit down and listen to it, but yeah, I don't really have any. I can't really judge it. I know they're a good live band, that I do know.
Yeah, I always find it interesting because they have elements of like Southern rock, but they have elements of like Black Sabbath-y, doomy stuff with like a really hard hitting punk edge.
Yeah, totally.
The sludge label, which is what the Melvins are categorized as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, labels are created by the media, and even though I'm part of that, I don't believe in those. So what's
yeah?
Your...
Well, you know everything. Yes.
Sorry.
I'm sorry, Andy. You keep dropping out, so I didn't hear what you said.
I was about to say something, but you were talking, so I said sorry. Go ahead.
Oh. Yeah. I got nothing. That was it.
Okay. So what are your next plans as, you know, things are slowly starting to open up and everything? What are your next musical plans?
Well, we're recording here middle of May.
Nice.
Yeah, we never stop. Yeah, we're recording middle of May. we filmed a live performance here at my house a couple of weeks ago. And that's going to come out on Saturday, May 1st. So we've done that. You know, we've done a couple of live streams from the basement. This one we didn't do as a live stream. We kind of we had Tony Avila from Portland came up, and he brought his mixing board and, you know, all of his mics, and he mic'd up the room so we could get some better sound. And then we have another buddy of ours by the name of Dave Jimenez, and he came and set up a bunch of cameras. So we're going to, you know, it's going to be put together as, you know, semi professional as possible. And that's going to come out on May 1st. Yeah, and then we're recording the week of May 17th. And we've got six or seven solid songs. We have one cover that we might do. And then we'll put out another record. Yeah.
I'm looking forward to it, and you have to let me know when there's an EPK so I can review it before it comes out and give you guys some really
good
leading up to it. Because, like I said, I became a fan of The Accused and Tenet Wolf. No idea that you are involved in both of those bands or that I bought a record from you before actually talking to you. And I knew you were a 10-minute warning because, and then I found out you were in The Accused too, and I'm like, I feel like an asshole. Jack of all trades, master of none. Is that how you would describe it?
That's me. Yeah, that's me.
Once all this shit's over with, if I could get a decent vacation planned out, I'll have to take a trip out and visit you, man.
Totally, yeah. You're welcome. I'll show you around.
That would be awesome because you could show me, like, this hotel was once a show where bands like this would play with vomit on the floor. Like, you could give us the actual, like, historical type of tour. You know what I mean? Not like...
I can... Yep. Yeah, totally. I can do that.
Yeah, and I'm sure on the outskirts is where a lot of the music's happening now, at least from the others I've been told. Like up in Tacoma.
That's you know, that's the way it is. You know, we talked about this before. That's the way it is in, you know, most big cities now. You know, everybody's been moved out of the city. You know, New York City is the same way. You know, it's just like... You know, it's not the same as it used to be.
The snow's coming down harder. But, all right, so to finish up.
That's crazy.
Up here for you. What do you love about music?
I guess by now it's just, you know, part of my life. It's just part of what I do. You know, I'm going to do it for another year or so. I plan on stopping when I turn 60, and I'll be 59 this year. So I figure I've got about another, I got about another 16 months of music playing, and then I'm hanging it up.
You have to play New York so I can come see you. If you play near Buffalo or Rochester, I'll be there in a heartbeat.
Yeah, well, we will see what happens. I just don't know what's going to happen, you know, over the next year. We'll see how things turn out.
Yeah, I don't think anybody does. So, all right,
yeah.
Man, well, it's been an honor. I will get this.
Thank you.
Hot onto the press. I appreciate it. And take care, man. Don't be a stranger. Best wishes. Stay healthy, man.
Yeah. Yeah. Enjoy that snow.
Oh yeah.
It's crazy.
Oh yeah. It's preventing me from building my car.
Right on. All right, Andy.
All right. Take it easy, man.
All right, man. You take it easy. Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.